Door number 8 by Francis Rosenfeld. Door number 3. Alternate realities. Have the lessons from yesterday's field trip reached you yet? He asked, smiling politely. More than I care to process, she thought, still upset about the musts and the have-tos, but she answered in the same good-mannered vein. A few, I'm still analyzing them. Just remember, before we go through door number 3, that not every rule is there to be broken, but it helps, every now and then, to question your assumptions. It seems fitting, since we are on this subject, and given that all of these doors look more or less the same, to remind you of a rule that you shouldn't be breaking. Do you remember what I warned you about during our first encounter? Don't go through door number 8, she recited, trying very hard to suppress an eye roll. You say that, but you don't believe it, not in your heart, anyway. He probed her with a sharp gaze, and then, not finding what he was looking for, continued, slightly disappointed. Anyway, ready when you are. He took a bow, pointing towards the door. What's through there? You. They stepped through the door and found themselves back in her room, and she didn't feel any different at first. She just noticed some slight alterations in her clothing and hairstyle, alterations that suggested a substantially heftier monthly allowance. So, what now? She asked. Nothing, let's go out. Where are you taking me? She smiled. I wouldn't want to spoil the surprise. He smirked. They walked in silence towards the library, whose recently finished edition glistened in the afternoon sun. Welcome to the Bradford Science Wing. He mock-curtsied, very amused by her stunned expression. Any connection? She asked him, remembering that among the plethora of weird that surrounded their interaction, there was also the minor detail of their sharing a last name. She thought maybe he came from money. That's not exactly right, it's you who are an heiress, Miss Bradford. Get out of here. You should be able to remember all the details of your life here. In this alternate timeline, that's who you've always been. She did remember, her entire life so far, in fact, the school she had gone to, her home, her vacations with her parents, the fact that her father was alive, the admission process, the perfection standards she had always held herself to, her pets, her friends, her plans for the future. But how? She asked. Oh, I don't know, there are so many choices in our lives, it's almost impossible to figure out what precise collection thereof led to this specific outcome. Do you remember that technological process your father was working on but never managed to get off the ground? That's Bradford Industries. Beyond that, I'm not sure. You would be surprised of the impact of even minor decisions. How do you feel? I don't know, I'm still trying to get used to it. The same, I guess. You know, when I just started teaching this class, I thought showing people idealized versions of their lives would be a mistake, that it would make them feel burdened by their current circumstances and disappointed with themselves. Imagine my surprise to learn that, even at their most privileged, in their heart they felt exactly the same. I heard it over and over again. He glanced at her to see if he should continue. Although I must say that some people did decide to stay in the better version. Taylor kept ruminating as they walked around the library, to see the addition from all angles. The truth is I have to scour the alternate lives for hours, sometimes days, to find the particular stream where everything is as close to the standards of perfection people expect from existence as possible. More often than not, lives are externally driven and random, and all of the things that can happen to somebody will happen in at least one of the streams. You mean there are alternate lives where I'm already dead? She asked. Absolutely. He replied immediately. About half of them. At every point in your life, being alive or dead is a binary choice, isn't it? Hey, would you like to see your tombstone? Pass. So, if everything here is as close to being perfect as possible, why not stay? She uttered the question she was dying to ask. Personal fortune notwithstanding, my father is alive, for instance. That alone makes this life better. And you figure this Taylor's future will be better than the old ones? I don't know, it just feels like starting out at an advantage will automatically make for a better life. I wouldn't have to worry about money, like ever, she enumerated. Why are you so sure about that? There is no guarantee that if you stay here you'll get to keep your fortune. It's definitely possible. He postulated. You have to realize that all the choices you make, even the ones you consider inconsequential, change the trajectory of your life. Considering that we make hundreds of choices a day, imagine how difficult it would be to predict their combined outcome. Furthermore, you can only make choices about things if you know they exist. Like the wayfinding systems class? She mocked. How it is that you don't see that as a privilege, it's beyond me. He did not get upset. So, is there a room number 8 in this life? She asked. I honestly don't know, I only have so much time to prepare for class. Do you want to go check it out? But didn't we just come out of it as a means to getting here? Remind me to explain one-way doors to you sometime. So, what if I decide to stay here anyway? She insisted. A percentage of the people who go through the doors decide to stay wherever they happen to lead. You have free choice, I can't force you to go back. What about the remaining 5 doors? There are people who went through those other doors too, and decided to stay there. He answered. And they are the remaining 4 doors. Don't go through door number 8, remember? That's a bunch of crap, to tell you the truth. Why put a door there if you're not supposed to go through it? This is a test, isn't it? She tried to get a reaction out of him. A test of what? A choice between all this and the doors, she blurted. First of all, it's not an either-or, there is no rule that you can't have both, and second, if there was one, what would you choose? This isn't fair, she protested. Of course it isn't. Under normal circumstances you would be going to classes and not even dream of choosing between being an heiress and experiencing folded reality. Most people don't. How is that fair? So that's what this is? Folded reality? That's one way to describe it, he conceded. What else is there? Why don't you experience it and find out? He smiled. This was a test, wasn't it? She started laughing. And you already knew the outcome. I like to believe that I'm a reasonably good judge of character, so, yes, I kind of did. Can we head back now? What's the rush, Miss Bradford? Don't you want to see your library wing? Technically it's part of the school's library, and it was my father who provided for its construction, so I don't see how that makes it mine, but, by all means, lead the way, I wouldn't want to miss it. There is one thing that you definitely should get out of this experience. Remember how I asked you if you felt any differently about yourself now that you are born of privilege, and you said no? That should be a reminder that regardless of your circumstances you never were and never will be anything other than an equal to your fellow men, regardless of their station in life. Circumstances are a lot more fickle and transient than people believe them to be, both the good ones and the bad ones, but no matter what goes or stays, you remain. They continued exploring the surroundings, noticing what was the same, what was different, and after about an hour they headed back to the dorm. It's been my experience that this is a difficult choice for people to make, to walk through a door between the perfect life and whatever wonders are still veiled by the great unknown, and no matter what they choose they always feel disempowered, like they have lost, not gained something. It's a purely emotional reaction, but a very powerful one, so we decided after a few years to leave that door unlocked, so that people always have that option of the perfect life available to go back to, if they so choose. It makes it easier for them to take a chance on being open to new things, if they don't feel crushed by the bitterness of somehow having forfeited their one chance at happiness. Who's we? Why don't we concentrate on your instruction for now? He smiled enigmatically. Do people ever go back? Taylor asked. Sometimes, but they never stay. In all the decades I have taught this class, none of those who originally decided to return go back through door number 3 in order to stay. How come? I guess people get used to considering their present activities a better use of their time. You mean like realizing they are too old for the merry-go-round? Something like that. What about my father? You can go back and visit if you'd like, but don't let too much time pass. You don't know what is going to happen in either reality. The farther you are from this point in time, the wider the futures branch out, and the lower the probability that what you'll find upon walking through that door looks like it does now. You do know what's going to happen here, don't you? I took a peek, he finally admitted. He's not going to be here much longer, is he? What makes you think this is about him? She didn't expect to be presented with a version of events where her no longer being alive was an actual possibility. Like most young people, she had explored the concept of life and death only from a philosophical perspective, not a practical one. So, you purposefully took me to and were willing to leave me in a reality where I am supposed to check out early, and very soon no less? So much for the one-to-one control doors, I feel a lot safer now? Are you actively trying to extinguish me? I never said that you were going to die, but hypothetically speaking, if that were the case, I would have tried to convince you to reconsider, with all the persuasive means at my disposal, and they are not meager. Second, free will is free will. If you thought that was a choice worth making, even for a short time, it was your right to pursue it, since you are the one burdened with its consequences. Third, as I said, the futures are branching out even as we speak. Who is to say that one of those choices wouldn't have changed the outcome? And last, for the people who decide to stay, there is no amount of explanation, demonstration, or supplication that would convince them you don't want to rip them off or take away their chance somehow. So I learned not to preach what I think is the better option. Why didn't you search until you found another life where I could have had all of that without an untimely demise? Because there is no such thing as the perfect life. Way too many choices to keep under control. For what it's worth, the tailor that you will become is going to be wealthier than the tailor in that life. Taylor was eager to meet with Christine. She felt a little off, and she was hoping for a kind word, or even mundane gossip, accompanied by revoltingly unhealthy comfort food. She went to Christine's dorm right after class and passed by the guy with the smiling eyes and the lightness of being just as her friend was opening the door. The latter looked very upset and, to Taylor's total shock, upset at her. "What's going on?" she asked her friend. It was definitely not what she was hoping to get out of this interaction. "You can have that dog if you like him so much," Christine snapped, furious. "What did I do? I don't understand, Christine. Don't tell me you didn't just stare at him right now." "Oh, I so don't need this crap right now," Taylor thought, and got ready to turn around and go back to her room, or the library, or anywhere else where this revolting melodrama was not. "So you just figured you'd walk away from me, didn't you? You come back in here right now, you owe me that much? You know, Taylor, I never peg you for a two-faced backstabber, but I guess I was wrong, wasn't I? Can you at least tell me what you are upset about?" Taylor decided, against every instinct in her body, to stick around and get to the bottom of this scene. The melodrama promised to turn a lot more familiar to her than she was willing to endure. "Any moment now she is going to call me a selfish and ungrateful brat, who has no idea how hard life really is. You want to tell me that you didn't go out with Matt the other night?" "Who's Matt?" Taylor asked, really surprised. "Like you don't know he's my boyfriend. Or was. I'm so done with that philandering slime. Men are pigs," she declared, and the last of the comments seemed to have let out some of her rage. Unfortunately, that also allowed enough rationality back into her psyche to turn back the battery on her friend again. "I know you two were out together, I saw you. How could you do this to me, Taylor?" "How's he your boyfriend?" Taylor blurted out, confused over the term, not realizing she had unnecessarily painted herself into a little penalty corner of fiery disdain. "You went on your first date 2 days ago. And that gives you license to steal him from me? Is this the kind of friend you are, Taylor?" "It wasn't me, I swear." "Do you want me to swear to you? How can I make you believe me?" the latter interrupted, exasperated, trying to end this absurd conversation. "Oh, yeah? Okay." Christine decided to fake prosecutorial calm. "What were you doing yesterday at 4:30? "Of course there were strings attached," Taylor thought, instantly irritated. "How could I be so stupid to trust that miserable if I don't almost die of exposure or get picked up for illegal border crossing? There has to be some other unpalatable consequence, hasn't it?" She quickly decided that two could play this game, and told her friend what she knew to be the truth, without any additional explanations. "I was at the library to check out the plans for the new science wing." "With whom?" Christine continued, unrelenting. "With my next-door neighbor. We finally got acquainted." "And you just happened not to know that he's Matt's best friend?" Christine's anger resumed. "They spend all their time together, there is no way Matt wasn't there too." "Believe it." Taylor started looking again for ways to wrap up this ridiculous circus performance, for which she had absolutely no taste. "Swear to me that you aren't hitting on him. Swear to me and I'll believe you. Christine attacked her, with a crazed look in her eyes. Christine, I don't care about your boyfriend or ex-boyfriend or whatever he is at this time. I'm sorry I bothered you, I'm late for class now, I have to go. You are lying. I saw your roster, you don't have any classes right now, I know you are going to see him, do you think I'm stupid? Taylor knew from past experience that there was no rational explanation she could come up with to convince this person her friend had turned into, that she wasn't entitled to her righteous anger, so she just turned around and left, and as she did, she heard the door slam noisily behind her. How lucky am I that they still make soup? She thought, instantly comforted by the thought of something warm and savory to eat. Food never lets you down. She thought, no matter how despicable people are, I can still enjoy soup. Fate works in mysterious ways, it seems, because the cafeteria was out of soup, and so was every single food establishment from one end of the campus to the other. All they had to offer were day-old baked goods and soggy salad. Thanks, jerk, she thought, and caught herself looking up to address the admonition as if her self-appointed guide was there. She got even more irritated that somehow in her mind, the bane of her existence belonged upstairs and or had anything to do with the absence of her favorite food. Comfort-free zone indeed, she continued ranting inside her head. She missed the step off the curb and tore an essential strand of her sandal, accident which made said piece of footwear unusable. This keeps getting better and better, doesn't it? Her exasperation grew, and she walked funny all the way to the shoe store, which just happened to be at the opposite end of the campus, to buy new footwear. As she was paying for it, she noticed that the locksmith had already charged her for fixing the door lock, despite the fact that he wasn't planning to show up for another couple of weeks. God, I hate people, she thought, exasperated, and mused philosophically that it's often the little things in life that build up to make it unbearable, and not the epic tragedies. Her mind got instantly flooded, in response to this ungrateful thought, with a never-ending stream of maternal reproaches around the subject, phrases with which she was so well acquainted, she could recite them in her sleep, and she feared she occasionally did. Strangely enough, today she was loath to notice she agreed with one or two of her mother's opinions, much as she was trying not to. Like, for instance, the fact that many people would be happy to have any food at all, even if it came in the guise of soggy bread and sour salad. She tried to show some gratitude for the ability to procure herself some form of nourishment, even if spiritual enlightenment hadn't hit her hard enough to make her actually eat the soggy salad sandwich, and she settled for a bag of chips and a cup of coffee instead. Her better spirits were finally returning, and she had drunk about half of her delicious coffee, when a couple of roughhousing dudes knocked it out of her hand, and continued their laughing and horseplay without even noticing their hapless victim. Okay, that does it. I've had it with the stupid day, the nut job friend, the La La Land room and the human nightmare next door. Life is hard enough without other people messing it up. While she was thinking this, a new and wondrous idea dawned on her. Door number 3 was still open. What if she went in that other reality and availed herself of the opportunities her fortune provided to scour the land far and wide and find that cup of soup she really wanted? This thought seemed like the most brilliant and innovative idea she had ever had. See? She thought, if you adapt a positive attitude towards life, the answers will come to you. She made an effort to ignore the fight with Christine and her friends ranting like a maniac over that eminently forgettable boyfriend of hers, and walk faster towards the dorm, in anticipation of a luxurious and well-deserved cup of soup from the other side of reality. The street was crowded, much more than she remembered it being on other days, and from the shoe store to her dorm, no less than 17 people she barely knew stopped her to strike a conversation, and all the conversations dragged on and on, centered on those other people's plans, upsets, indisputable righteousness and, God help her, hurt feelings, and she had to listen patiently to their complaints and rationalizations, so they didn't think she was raised by wolves. She could have, of course, interjected a mild complaint of her own, but the thought of whining over a torn sandal strand, soggy bread and spilled coffee, felt kind of embarrassing. Maybe her mother was right and she never had any real problems after all. Christine, well, that was another story, and certainly not one meant for public debate, because even in ranting form, Christine was her best friend, and her romantic problems were none of these people's business. She grew more and more impatient and irate the closer she got to the dorm, and her mood was now shot to such a degree that a cup of soup and pampered service weren't going to restore it. Would you mind finding somewhere else to go for a couple of hours? The maintenance guy stopped her on the stairs. We bug bomb the building to get rid of the ants, and you can't be in your room until then. Of course I can't. Why could I? Well, that makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it? She turned on her heels, not even angry anymore at the fact that God, the universe, her imaginary neighbor, or existence itself, had simply decided to deny her a cup of soup that day. Taylor had never believed in coincidences, so the concept that this whole string of events simply happened didn't sit well with her. She figured she'll find out the answer eventually. Strange as it may seem, life always provided her with explanations, even if much later, so she had learned to have patience and understand them when they finally arrived. She shrugged off the upset that had been building throughout the day and went to the bookstore, then the library, where she found many items of interest, stopped to research some things she wanted to learn for some time now, finished her school assignments for the following day, checked out a traveling exhibit that was only there that evening, enjoyed a beautiful sunset, and found her favorite jacket, which she had lost, in the library's lost and found bin. It was already dark when she headed back to the dorm, and as she walked up the stairs to her room, the acrid smell of bug spray hit her nostrils in a nauseating combination of insecticide and flowers, hyacinths, she guessed, and she wished she could sleep somewhere else, at least for the night, until the air cleared. That made her remember the fight she had with Christine, who would have been the obvious choice for her rescue. She sighed, continued climbing, and tried to get used to the smell. People change over their lifetime, it's all part of learning and growing, but there are a few core components of one's personality that will survive just about anything. Those few traits are essential in defining you as a person, and as such, to use a computer term, are right protected, because their modification would be too damaging for the self to maintain structural integrity. Such traits are not always endearing, of course, and Taylor's stubbornness was an example of such a trait. As those unfortunate enough to be on the receiving end of this quality of hers knew, once she had made up her mind about a specific plan, not even the end times could move her from her purpose. It just so happened that at this point in her life, Taylor's purpose was to procure for herself and enjoy a cup of soup. When other people are exposed to the miracles of the universe beyond their understanding, they usually covet fame, fortune, beauty, or eternal youth. Taylor just wanted her cup of soup. The first thing she did, therefore, upon waking up the next day, was to pretty herself up and walk through door number 3 to hunt the desired broth at the cafeteria inside her library wing. Her attire didn't change when she passed through the door this time, and she congratulated herself for wearing something new and pretty, and which made her feel good about herself. On the way to the library, she remembered that she was in fact meeting her best friend Jessica and her newest boyfriend Matt. What surprised Taylor was the absolute consistency of this alternate universe. One would have thought, under the circumstances, that meeting with the person who had created such gratuitous drama in her other life the day before, to aid and abet in the behavior that ended up generating said drama, would have engendered intolerable cognitive dissonance in Taylor's mind, but this whole alternate scenario felt absolutely natural to her. She had just walked through the door of the cafeteria when she noticed Jessica's gaze assessing her countenance with the cold and impartial demeanor of a 64-slice CAT scan machine. "She hates my outfit." The thought immediately popped up in Taylor's mind. She had known Jessica since kindergarten, and she could read her unspoken signals like no other. "Did the airport lose your luggage?" Jessica asked casually. The superior attitude would have annoyed Taylor under different circumstances, but she'd been known to throw a barb or two in her day, so she chose to retort instead. "No. When did you start dyeing your own hair? It looks a bit frizzy." As if, Jessica tried to act unaffected by the comment, but surreptitiously checked the tips of her flawless hairstyle for any evidence of split ends, and decided to start shopping around for a new hairstylist. Lucky for Taylor, she was not aware of having had negatively impacted the fate of a hardworking person she didn't even know, so she was spared the guilt. "Hi, Matt." Taylor acknowledged the presence of the second person at the table. The latter barely looked at her and continued checking his phone. Whatever it was that he was following on it was obviously more important than displaying good manners. "Oh, ignore him, he's in the doghouse." Jessica dismissed the behavior of her boyfriend with the same detachment one would use to watch a cat cross the street. She continued talking about him in the third person, as if he wasn't there. "Can you believe he's trying to sweet-talk that pathetic little thing? What's her name? Christine, is it?" She suddenly turned to Matt for confirmation. Matt ignored her. Taylor started feeling very uncomfortable about being set up as the default arbiter in this quasi-domestic spat. Jessica had an almost acquisitive approach to relationships, and her current fondness for Matt, if one wanted to call it that, was no different in many ways from the attachment she had for her terrier, and demanded the same qualities in return: good looks, perfect grooming, and absolute obedience. Taylor didn't know whether to feel sorry for Matt or be annoyed at him for souring what she was hoping would be a good day, and then figured that the second episode in the Matt melodrama really didn't concern her, and let Jessica go on with her description of the situation while she browsed the menu for the coveted food item. She found soup on the list, and her face lit up for a second with the ineffable joy only the simple pleasures of life can bring. Apparently they belong to the same study group, Jessica explained. Isn't that how we met, sweetheart? She asked Matt, who ignored her again. Okay. Taylor thought. The price of this cup of soup is getting ridiculously high, maybe I should just give up and spare myself the view from the other side of this unholy love triangle. She was thinking up an excuse, not an easy feat, mind you, since she and Jessica, as previously mentioned, had known each other since kindergarten. Christine, Jessica continued mercilessly. Can you believe it? She said, and upon noticing that Taylor was still looking at the menu, she changed her tone. I'm sorry, dear, am I boring you? It seems you found yourself a new hobby. She smiled bitterly. You should really watch that comfort eating, the pounds tend to sneak up on you. She bent sideways to observe the seat of Taylor's chair. Oops, it looks like it's already too late. What's wrong with Christine? Taylor decided to throw a sharp little knife in response. She looks like a very nice girl. Well, at least that part is true, she thought. The waiter was there, smiling and waiting for them to order. Can I have a cup of soup, please? She smiled back at him. Thank you. Okay, that's it, Jessica snapped, exasperated, grabbing the menu out of her hands. What's wrong with you? What do you mean? Since when do you eat soup? Oh, my God. Is your family going through financial trouble? You are always welcome to stay in one of my apartments, you know that, right? As appealing as this sounds, Taylor thought and replied out loud, what makes you think we're having financial difficulty? Why else would you consider eating soup for lunch? Jessica answered, as if it was totally obvious to anybody with the proper pedigree, while the waiter was still standing behind them, smiling and waiting patiently for a decision to be made. Taylor noticed him and nodded to confirm that she indeed wanted soup, mortified by the awkwardness of the situation, and hoping he didn't hold it against her. The guy jotted down the order and left. He didn't seem to care much, they probably weren't the first group of unpleasant people he had to deal with that day. You need an intervention, Jessica said decisively. Taylor anticipated the tinge of misguided self-righteousness that she knew so well, and instantly decided to lean on Matt's side of the argument. There was no way she was going to have Jessica dictate her food, no matter how well-intentioned the latter believed herself to be in her efforts to fix her looks, weight, social acceptability and attire, so she thought she would eat her soup, which for some reason had suddenly lost all of its appeal, and run, not walk, to the door back into her normal reality, whatever normal meant. First that embarrassing outfit, and now this? No wonder you can't see what's wrong with that mousy little thing, you're starting to turn into her. Seriously, Jessica. Could you dial down the drama just a little bit so I can enjoy one measly cup of soup in peace? Taylor sighed, hopeless. She knew Jessica was going to blow up this argument into one of her now notorious public scenes, performances to which she felt entitled because nobody in her pampered life had ever told her otherwise. I can't believe I'm even talking to you right now, it would kill me if somebody saw me in your company while you're wearing that outfit, you're not eating your stupid soup while we're sitting at this table together, that's for sure. Well, I see that you're in a bad mood, we'll just get together some other time then. Taylor smiled politely and excused herself. That will be the day, she thought as she walked away, vowing to never, ever, for any reason, ever come back to this reality again. Come back here immediately. I'm not done talking to you. Nobody walks out on me, nobody. What, you think you're so smart? How pathetic is it that your daddy had to buy the college a library wing, so you can get accepted? Jessica was considering other insults she could throw at her friend as Taylor walked out of the cafeteria. The latter recalled acing her SATs, as well as every other school assignment. This was an issue that had dogged her entire life, this unspoken assumption that all of her achievements were purchased, and somehow she had no merit in her own accomplishments. The thought of being born of privilege as an oppressive burden felt insulting to the people who had not been blessed with her opportunities, so she automatically repressed it over the background of Jessica's last rant, uttered very loudly to make it more poignant. Worthless half-wit? Walking back to the dorm room, Taylor pondered whether she should have asked for the soup in a to-go cup. Strange as it may seem, despite the unpleasantness of the encounter, that special core component of her personality didn't let her forget the reason that had brought her to a universe where Jessica was her best friend, so she returned to the carry-out counter to find out if she could still get her soup after all. "Sorry," the clerk said, smiling apologetically. "I just learned that we have run out of soup. Could I interest you in something else? Our cherry pie is delicious. Fresh out of the oven." "No, thank you." Taylor flashed her a bright smile that masked her disappointment. "Well," she thought, dragging her feet out the door to get back to room number 8, "there's something I should keep in my lessons learned folder. If life says no soup for you, it does so consistently throughout all the alternate realities." She wondered if existence had made an effort to remove soup from the half of the universes where she was already dead, and thought that would have been an interesting answer to get, but sadly the option of going to one of those alternate realities was no longer available to her. She'd certainly been offered it, she remembered, and she laughed out loud at the richness of choices wasted on those who receive them unaware. In the same thought, almost, she remembered that her teacher wasn't sure whether the doors on the other side would lead her back to her old life, and his insistence that she mustn't go through the doors alone, and realized she had just risked losing existence, as she knew it, in her stubborn quest for a cup of soup.